Okay, so here I want to talk a bit about conceptual modeling and introduce it through the notion of affordances and metaphors and the work of Don Norman in particular. So I will start with this seminal book by Don Norman. It was originally called The Psychology of Everyday Things. And then when it was re-edited, his publisher said, you know, Psychology of Everyday Things, it's not very appealing. So they renamed it The Design of Everyday Things, and since it's been really a bestseller. It's a book that is really easy to read. It's not a research book, really. So then we'll talk about affordances, metaphors, conceptual model, and examples. So Don Norman was a professor at the University of California at San Diego, a cognitive psychologist. And so we talked about action theory and these things. And in the late 80s, he went to spend a year in England. And he wanted to go to Europe, but he thought, you know, if I go to England, same language at least, so it will be easier for me. And what he discovered there is that he had trouble with, you know, everyday things like dealing with washing machines and telephones and I don't know, have you ever been to England? Yes? No? No?
Scotland.
Yeah, well, Scotland. Well, I spent some time in England and I encountered some of the same things. Like when you want to turn the key to lock a door, it's the opposite direction. The cold and hot water in the sink, they are also opposite. It's even more confusing because instead of being coded blue and red, usually it says C for cold and H for hot. But they're reversed, so C is on the right. But C in French means chaud, hot. So several times, you know, I got tricked. And so he realized that even for, you know, everyday things, everyday tasks, we are really used to certain, say, culture and ways of doing things. And when we are confronted with something that works differently, it's very disturbing. And so he introduces the notion of affordance that he took from Gibson but turned into cultural affordances. And he talked about the role of metaphors for designing interfaces and introduced this notion of a conceptual model that I've already talked about. So, by the way, this is the new cover of his book. Do you know this red coffee holder, cafetière, what's the word for a coffee pot? So this is a part of a series of things that were created by a French artist called Karel Mann. It was called the Catalogue des Objets Introuvables, the catalogue of unexisting objects or impossible to find objects. He was inspired by the early catalogues that in French is the La Redoute catalogue, you know, that would sell you anything for your house. And so he created these weird objects that. So this one is called a coffee pot for masochists, as you can understand why. And it's interesting because it's looking at objects we know very well, and just by changing them a little bit, it makes them different. And so speaking of problems with food-related items, this is two designs for cooking stove. So they both have stoves? Four furnaces, yes. So if you are using the one at the top and you want to make this one hot, what do?
You look at the character?
Yes. So you have the row of dials at the top, and you try to look if there's any indication of which controls which. Now, if you have the one at the bottom, is it easier?
Yes.
Yes.
Why? Because there is
the same positions.
There is a direct mapping, unless the designer was really twisted and did it differently. But you know, you don't have to ask a question about how this works. So this is the type of example that he's giving in the book. And what he's arguing is that objects can have affordances that allow you to immediately know how to use them without having to learn or discover or do trial and error. So he starts from the notion of affordance from Gibson, the direct perception of the capabilities of an object for action. And I insist on this definition because it shows that an affordance is not a property of an object. You will find many descriptions of affordances in the literature that says, oh, it's the capability of an object for action. It's not just the capabilities, it's the fact that you can perceive them and you can perceive them directly. And you can perceive them directly for a given action. And so the shape, the size, the aspect, in the previous case, the layout of an object immediately suggests what you can use it for. It's obvious from the example here at the bottom that, you know, which dial to turn to get which thing warm. So Gibson's affordances were innate. They didn't require learning. Things like affordance of passing through an opening in a wall and things like this. Norman's notion of affordance are cultural. They require learning, but they are universal with this culture. And so, for example, if you are in the UK, you know that to lock the door, you have to turn this way. And if you are in France, you know you have to turn this way. And when you see a keyhole, it immediately suggests turn it one way or the other to close it or open it. In fact, Norman talks a lot about handles. If you have a handle like we have on the door here, again, it's a cultural thing. You know to push it down. I mean, there's, you know, technically it would be as easy to make it so you push it up or down to open. Why down? Well, maybe it's more natural gesture, but it's still something we learn. But you know that in many public places, you have these doors that you have to push or pull, and usually they have a large bar in front of them. And so the affordance of the bar is usually more for pushing, for pulling. And even if you write push, you know that half the people will make the mistake. So just through the shape of a handle, you can suggest whether something needs to be pushed or pulled. In fact, on the side where you should push it, there shouldn't be any handle, just a plate. So if you don't have something that affords pulling it, people won't pull. So his argument is that these affordances are really the foundation for the knowledge that we have of the world around us. And this is a quote from, probably not from the book, but from a paper. It says, much of our everyday knowledge resides in the world, not in the head. And so we constantly pull that knowledge from the world, combine it, in fact, with the knowledge we have in our head. But a lot of the knowledge is externalized in the world. And so I've already talked about mental models that allow us to represent the world in our heads. And we really build mental models by observing regularities in the world. And those regularities have to do in particular with the link between causes and effects. You know, when I do this movement with the handle, it does open the door. And so that's really what I remember. And so these mental models are constantly used to help us understand what we see, explain it, and predict what would happen if I did this or that, and therefore help us plan, say, well, if I want to get to this goal, here is how I have to do it. So I don't have time to go into mental models and how they work and the various theories around them. But what's important here is that we have knowledge in our head, but we rely on the knowledge that is out in the world that we can directly perceive. And so when you design an interface, you're trying to create an artificial world where you are trying to build on these notions of mental model and affordances. And so one effective way of transferring knowledge we have of the real world into the computer world is to use metaphors. So a metaphor is a figure of speech that establishes the link between two words without explicitly comparing them. If I do a comparison, I include the comparative. So, for example, if I say the moon is a golden sickle, do you know what a sickle is? It's a faucille in French. It's a tool that has the shape of the moon that you use to cut crop. So if I say the moon is a golden sickle, I don't say, you know, the shape of the moon is similar to the shape of the... I don't explain the comparison. I just evoke two words, the moon, and preferably it's better if there is a moon like this in the sky rather than a full moon. And I use the word sickle, and in your head, you will establish the link. I can even... go further and say and do a direct metaphor, like a golden sickle lights the night. So I don't even talk about the moon. But because I'm talking about the night, something that lights the night has to be the moon. Sickle, moon, yes, the same shape. So you see this process of association. And the idea is that you transfer relationship and properties from one object to the other. Now, this is a literary relationship, so I don't see what property other than the shape of a sickle would be transferred to the moon. So maybe this is not such a good example. But the notion of a metaphor is that you are essentially, through this association, making it implicit that some properties of the object being compared apply to the object you are, that is, the target of the task. And of course, this only works if this transfer is immediately guessed and understood. If you don't know what is a sickle, or if I'm telling you the moon is a golden sickle and it's a full moon, you right? It's not going to work. So it has to work immediately. So of course, in our context, of computers, the most well-known metaphor is a desktop metaphor. And the idea here is to map and compare objects of the real desk with objects of the virtual desk. And the desktop metaphor came up in the Xerox Star because they were designing a system for secretaries, executive secretaries, and the domain they were dealing with were, you know, folders and documents and input and output mail and wastebasket and things you find in this environment. And so the idea is that they didn't simulate a real desk, they didn't try to make these things realistic, neither in their representation nor in the way you use them. But they tried to take advantage of knowledge of a real desk so you could guess how the virtual desk would work. So things like moving things around, opening, putting in a trash can, and things like this. So if a metaphor is well done, it will save learning by capitalizing on external knowledge that you already have, and will take advantage of affordances in the real world to... in fact, infer affordances of the virtual world. Now, a good metaphor is also something you will push further than the real world. So there are things in the virtual desktop that you can do that cannot be done in the real world. Things like undo, for example. Although some forms of undo have been made to be metaphorical. So the fact that you put things in the wastebasket, in a trash can, and then you empty the trash can, means that while it's still there, you can still recover it. But, you know, in the real world, if I've crumpled a piece of paper, put it in the waste basket, if I recover it, it's not going to be exactly in its previous shape. Here, I can make it so it is exactly in its previous shape. So it's this whole game of, you know, using these comparisons and parallels, but not being too literal. And so it's difficult to do right. So, for example, there was a system called the magic cap. I thought I had an image here. That was done in the 90s, I think. It was one of the first system on a PDA, on a portable device. And what they did was literally to, you had a street and you would walk down the street and then you had your office and you would go in and you had sort of a 3D representation of your desk and there would be a phone that you had to dial. And they'd done things very literally. And the idea that it would be easier for people to use, but it was so painful to use that it just didn't work. So it was too literal. It was not metaphorical, it was literal. So when we create an interactive system, the designer is going to create a conceptual model. And I will get back to this in more detail, of how the system should be used. This conceptual model is going to be translated in what Norman calls a system image. It is what people actually see of the system. It's a system, it's also the documentation, if there is any that comes with it, or everything that comes with the system, but it's what people see. So users will use that system, and through this use, they will create a mental model, a model in their head of how the system works. And the whole key here is whether this mental model, in the end, will match the conceptual model that was in the designer's head. If it does, probably the system will be seen as easy to use, natural, you know. Because you're trying to do something, you feel, oh, this is the way it should be done, and bingo, it works. Because that's how the designer designed it. If there is no such mapping, if you have a mental model that does not match the conceptual model, you're trying to do something some way, and it doesn't work. Command is disabled. Why is it disabled? Well, the designer figured out that you had to do these other things before, so this thing would be possible, but that's not how your mental model works. And that's when you find a system difficult to use and all that. Now, it's very difficult to have this match because every user has a different history, different preferences, different habits, different ways to use a system. So you have as many mental models as there are users. So to have a conceptual model that will work is really hard. And what happens a lot of the time is not enough of the conceptual model is visible in the system image for users to create the proper mental model. That's usually what a lot of the problems are. And Donnerman talks a lot about making things visible. I've talked a lot about feedback. This is what allows users to create the proper mental model. So the task of conceptual modeling is really about creating a conceptual model which has to be informed by how users work, because if you don't know how users are likely to want to use your system, it will be hard to create a conceptual model that matches their mental model. And so that's one part. The second part is designing the system image, what the user sees of the system, and how it will be able to infer the conceptual model from there. And then the user mental model is try to anticipate how people will create mental models based on what they see. And so a lot of the design work and a lot of what you will do in the CoE class for design and evaluation of interactive systems for those who take it will be to, through various techniques, come with a conceptual model and the system image, which you will realize through paper prototypes, and then do evaluations to see, you know, how people really understand it, and then loop and update the conceptual model, the system image, and see if it improves the system. And the reason we have to do this incrementally is because, you know, there is no Fitts law that allows to predict how things are going to work. So using metaphors help if you do it well. Taking advantage of affordances help. And a lot of this is usually captured in design guidelines. That also helps with the notion of homogeneity or consistency between applications. Because people will transfer knowledge from the physical world into the computer, but especially nowadays, they will transfer their knowledge from other computer systems, other applications, to a new application. And as I said, manipulation errors, frustration, and lower productivity is what happens if you don't have this proper match with the conceptual model. So here's an example that had dire consequences, I think. Maybe you remember the presidential election in the US. That was when Al Gore was against George Bush. And the race was very close. And one thing to know is that in the US, they have a different voting system than we have in France. I don't know how it is in your country, Greece, or but in France, it's very simple. You have one piece of paper per candidate, and if you can read, you pick the piece of paper for your candidate, put it in an envelope, put that in the box. In the US, they tend to have a system where all the names of the candidates are in a single sheet of paper, and you have a mechanical system by which you can punch a hole in front of the candidate. It's also the case that each county has its own system, so they're not working all the same. And what happened in that election is that, especially in Florida, which was the key to the election, because you may know also that in the US, you vote not for the president. Well, you think you vote for the president, but in fact, you vote, and then the Electoral College votes for the president. So, depending on what candidate gets the majority in one state, all the Electoral College of that state will vote for that candidate. So it's not really a majority of what's called the popular vote of all the individual votes of the citizens. It's a majority at the Electoral College, which is a strange system in my perspective. But anyway, so Florida, the results of Florida were going to decide of the overall election. But what happened is that in some counties in Florida, they were observing weird results, in that the results were not matching the demographics for that particular county. And so in particular in the Palm Beach County, they had what they called the butterfly ballot. In general, these ballots only have one column of names with a hole to punch in front of it. But in here, because there were more candidates than usual, I guess, they had the names on the left and on the right. And so if you wanted to vote for George Bush, you would have to punch hole number three, there were two holes above that were not used. So here, there's this number three little arrow. If you want to vote for Pat Buchanan, who's it's called a reformist, is to the right of Bush, put things lightly, you would vote number four, the second hole here. If you wanted to vote for Al Gore, Democratic candidate, you would have to vote in front of this, which is hole number five. Now, what many people did is they looked at this, they looked George Bush, Al Gore, I want to vote for Al Gore, he's number two, I punch the second hole. And they voted for Pat Buchanan. In France, it's like, you know, wanting to vote for François Hollande and voting for Marine Le Pen instead. Now, this was probably made worse by the fact that in this particular county, and in most of Florida, to tell the truth, there are a lot of older people. So older people who don't have good sight and you know, are more likely to make mistakes, especially in those types of cases. And so if you look at the results, it is obvious, given the statistics we have on demographics and the observed votes, that a lot of people made this mistake. And, you know, there has been a lot of recounting of ballots to figure out if this would have changed the result, and we don't really know, because even after recounting, they couldn't figure out if it would have made a difference. But according to a number of studies, it would. So it can have important consequences. Now, here's another much less political example. It's a fridge. So here's a fridge. There's a freezer and a fridge. And you buy this thing, and you open the door, and you find these two dials, one that goes from A to E, and the other from seven down to 3. And then there's this little sticker next to it that says normal settings, it's C and 5. It's okay, well, it's in the middle of the two ranges. If you want colder, fresh food, which is the fridge, you should do C and then move the other one to the left, 6 and 7. But if you really want the coldest fresh food, you have to go to B and then 8 and 9, so I didn't put the whole range here. But if you want the colder freezer, you should do D and 7 and 8. And warmer fresh food would be C and 4 and 1. And so you read that and you start, you know, messing around with the dials, and you have to build a mental model of this. So we all know that to create cold in a fridge and a freezer, you need a compressor. And based on this, most people will come up with a system that says, well, by and large, it's the letters that control the temperature in the freezer, and it's the numbers that control the temperature in the fridge. Which is, I mean, yes, if you look at it, you first, I've focused your attention on it. Second, you're all engineering students, so you know you are geeks, so you're different. So yes, you'll see that the letters were also changing when I was doing temperature in the fridge. But you know, the natural model people will come up with is: I have a freezer, I have a fridge. One of these has to be controlling the fridge, and the other the freezer. But of course, that's not a real model. This is a cheaper fridge. It has only one compressor. And so the two settings, one controls the amount of cold that gets produced. That's the A to E. And the second is dialing how much goes into the fridge, how much goes into the freezer. But, you know, would you have inferred that? Maybe. You would have figured out that, you know, both were controlling. You have to use both, but I'm not sure you can come up really with that model just from this information. So now we have a problem, because of course the real mental conceptual model is really this one. And so how do we fix it? Well, one way would be to, in fact, draw this and show that to the users. So you don't fix the conceptual model, you try to fix the mental model by teaching the users what was the conceptual model. Does this make the fridge more usable? I don't know, because having to move two dials every time I want to change, you know, temperature in one side or the other doesn't seem really simple. In fact, Don Norman has a lot of examples with showers. You know, there are showers where you control temperature and amount of water. There are showers where you control cold and hot water separately, and there are some that are some strange combination of both. And in general, you know, the I don't remember what he calls it, but the natural variables for this is how much water do I want and what temperature I want the water. If I have cold and hot, by changing the amount of, say, hot, I'm changing both temperature and the amount of water. So these are not the natural variables for this problem. So the other approach is, of course, to fix the fridge to reflect the natural mental model. Now, fixing the fridge in this case does not necessarily mean putting in two compressors like here. I could still have a compressor and something that decides where the cold goes, but still put the two dials, except each dial would have to control the two devices. So it would be a more complex control system, but I still could fix it. And so when you design an interface, it's really important to have this conceptual model in mind. And to create good conceptual models, there are a few principles that are useful. The first one is make things visible. It must be the case that by observing the interface, I'm able to know what state it is in. I talked before about these text editors that have modes. You know, insert mode versus edit mode in VI. Now, a lot of people say, oh, modes are terrible. As I said before, not you need modes anyway. The problem with VI, at least the original VI, is you had no way to tell whether you were in insert mode or edit mode until you hit a key and see what happened. So making the mode visible, you know, solves most of the problem here. And how many times you are using system, you know, software where you don't know what to do or you're doing the wrong thing because you cannot tell if the system is in a particular mode. And this is particularly critical when things go wrong. So when you are in an error or the system doesn't work as expected. For example, if you are on the web and you're downloading something and you know, you see your progress bar and suddenly it stops. Well, you can tell the state of the system is stopped, but you have no way to tell if it's because something is really broken or it's just slow or this kind of thing. So you need to reveal more information when things don't go as expected. The second one is the mapping principle. It's really to help users understand the mapping between what they do and what the system does, so actions to results. The controls and their effects, which was the example with the fridge here, the state of the system and what is visible. Our brain works by association. Memory is associative, plans are associative. Most of what we know about how the brains work is really about creating associations. So help the user understand this association. And the feedback principle is, in fact, in my opinion, really a natural consequence of the first two. It's about making visible to the user, what the system is doing and how the system is interpreting what you are sending in. Sending it as commands. Now, based on these three basic design rules, there are many, 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 many sets of rules that have been created over the years that, you know, they more or less take these three rules and make them more concrete. Sometimes they add things like learning, for example. So Schneiderman has these 8 design rules. Consistency. But consistency is really a consequence of trying to reuse the same mappings in different applications, making things that are the same, work the same, look the same, respond to similar actions. Shortcuts for expert users. Well, that's something that maybe was not really in Norman's system, but the idea is that as people become more expert, their mental model can do sort of more prediction, and so you don't need to give maybe as much feedback, or especially if this is slowing users down, and on the contrary, you need to make some ways to do the same actions more efficiently. So it's really the transition from novice or intermittent user to expert that is important. So informative feedback, we talked about this. Design dialogues with closures, the notion that, you know, if I need to know when I'm done with some task. Prevent errors, so graying out commands. The main goal of this is to prevent you from selecting a command that will tell you, oh, I can't do it. And it helps build a mental model of, oh, when I do this, this grays out or becomes active, so I can learn dependencies and causality. Help repair them means giving messages that provide examples of solutions. So for example, it used to be the case on the Macintosh that if you try to copy a file and there's not enough room, it will tell you not enough room, which, you know, tells me about the error but not how to repair it. In a more advanced version, it would tell you, well, there is not enough room, the file you're trying to copy is 2 gigabytes, I only have 1 gigabyte left. So it didn't help you repair it, but it gave you information about, you know, it means now I have to find 1 gigabyte of space. One step beyond was, because they don't do this anymore, unfortunately, was to say, well, you need 1 gigabyte of extra space, and by the way, if I empty the trash, it will free enough space for you to copy the file. So it would even give you one solution. Provide reversible operations, important because, as I've said before, humans learn by doing, by trial and error. Give control to the user, that's to me a given in direct manipulation. And reduce short-term cognitive load, which is really externalizing state, like the mode you're in VI, rather than forcing the user to hold it in his head. Now, down this line, you'll find entire books, sometimes in multiple volumes, that give you ergonomic rules for, you know, turning this into practical things. The bottom line, though, is that for every rule, there is usually exceptions. And so none of these rules has to be taken as an absolute rule. There are times where you want to make things special and different. There are operations that you cannot undo, so you have to warn the user. There are cases where you assume your system is going to be used only by well-trained users, so you don't have this problem of making as many things visible or all that. There's always a trade-off about, you know, more information and too much information. So sometimes giving more feedback, giving more information will, in fact, decrease productivity or performance. So I will stop here for this morning. What we'll see in the next part of this lecture is more practically how you go about building a conceptual model. And then I'll show you one way of doing it based on this conceptual model we've seen before. It's not the only way to do a conceptual model, but it's one that I find works pretty well for at least simple systems. So, do you have any questions?